Prototyping is a crucial tool in the development of websites and other digital services. So in this little podcast episode, I explore its potential and share some tips and techniques for getting the most out of it. Because although popular, prototyping is often misunderstood. People fail to get the full value from it because they're approaching it in the wrong way. The result is that when deadlines are pressing and budgets are tight, prototyping is often the first thing to be cut. Instead, organisations leap into production or fall back on lengthy specification documents in the hope of shortcutting the process. Of course, in the end, they achieve precisely the opposite. I want to make this particular episode a comprehensive introduction to prototyping, so it's going to take a little while. I want to share with you 22 years of experience of building prototypes. I want to show you that prototypes have got a lot more potential than you might initially suspect. If that sounds good, then keep listening. Let's start with what exactly a prototype is. Most of us have got a vague idea of what we mean when we talk about a prototype, but how does that relate to a website or mobile app? To my mind, a prototype is a proof of concept that can be used to validate an idea for a user interface. That might be as simple as a hand-drawn sketch or as elaborate as an interactive, fully designed experience. In between these two extremes, there are a variety of different approaches. Approaches that each have their pros and cons, serving different purposes. For example, you could argue that a design mock-up of a user interface is a type of prototype. It's highly designed, but lacks any interactivity. That means it's good for validating visuals, but poor for usability testing. Then there's wireframes. Wireframes are typically lower quality visually and so quicker to produce. They're good for testing visual hierarchy with users and whether they know what to do on a particular page, but they offer little in terms of testing aesthetics. That said, wireframes can vary in design detail and could even be linked together to allow limited navigation. It's possible also to build HTML prototypes too. These are good for usability testing, visual hierarchy and navigation. They could also allow testing across devices. Their downside is that they could be more time consuming to create, especially as richer design or interactivity are added. Finally, there are prototypes that mimic the user interface as much as possible. The aim of these prototypes is to provide an accurate sense of what the final experience will be like for testing without having to write any of the underlying code and functionality. This type of prototyping is probably the most time-consuming of all, but gives the most accurate picture of what it is that you're building. You may be thinking all of this sounds very time-consuming and hard to justify, and that's not an unusual response, but the benefits of prototyping are huge. I don't see prototyping as a tool that can just help design better interfaces. I believe, like so many parts of design thinking, it can actually benefit all areas of the business. Many ideas fail not because that they're flawed, but because people just don't get them. It can be hard to imagine new products, services, or features, and that's where a traditional specification document or business plan can fail. They don't excite people about the potential, and they don't show what could be done. When staff at Disney wanted to persuade the executives to invest $1 billion in renovating their parks to support a better user experience, they turned to prototyping. Instead of writing a document that only appealed to the executives on a rational level, they built a prototype so management could feel what that better experience could be. When so many companies now differentiate on quality and service, how something feels is incredibly important. A prototype enables you to experience that and so excites stakeholders about what is possible. Prototypes are a great way of unifying people around a shared vision, but it also has another related benefit. Another advantage of prototyping over documentation, like business plans and specifications, is that it reduces the chances of misunderstanding. A paper that describes what you're going to build requires people to imagine the final solution. That needs a degree of interpretation on the part of the reader. A prototype, on the other hand, shows stakeholders what they're going to get, what's going to be built. That means everyone has the same picture of the end goal. It significantly reduces the need for people to fill in the gaps with their imagination. Many stakeholders struggle to imagine what a final product or service will look like. Not only does that lead to misunderstanding, it also creates scope creep. The clarity that a prototype can bring will reduce the amount of scope creep, as much of that scope creep is born out of misinterpretation. But prototypes reduce scope creep for another reason too. To understand why a prototype reduces scope creep, one must first understand why it occurs. And one of the main reasons is stakeholders struggle to think through the specifics of a digital service that you're building. It's not until they start seeing it that they realize what's missing or what should be different. By producing a visual representation of the product in the early days, it helps stakeholders to see what's missing and what's wrong early on, while things can easily be adjusted. But it's not just stakeholders who will be able to spot shortcomings in your solution. Users can too. One of the primary reasons for creating a prototype is to have something you can test, a tangible product that you can put in front of users and they can try out. By testing with users, it's possible to identify problems early when fixing them is still inexpensive. But testing a prototype can do a lot more than just identify problems. You see, in the early days of a project, we make a lot of assumptions about what the user wants. Some companies do market research, but just like stakeholders, users often struggle to picture what it is that you are proposing building. By creating a prototype, users can try out the service that you're considering building. They can provide feedback and save you a lot of money. For example, you might be considering building a specific piece of functionality that turns out users don't really want. Alternatively, you might have missed something that users considered essential and would have been expensive to add later. Testing a prototype allows you to validate the assumptions you make and be confident you're building the right thing. Digital projects are very different from other types of projects. In traditional projects, upfront planning is crucial because the cost of changing direction once the project is underway is prohibitive. But when it comes to digital, pixels are cheap. It's easy to experiment and try different approaches until you find the perfect way forward. The cost is even more affordable when you're working with a prototype. You can quickly build ideas and test them before improving them through iteration. Combined with the unprecedented level of data that you can gather on a prototype, this allows you to quickly iterate towards your minimal viable product and even beyond. All of the advantages we've outlined so far boil down to a single compelling argument, which is that prototypes save the business money. That's ironic considering one of the biggest excuses for not prototyping is the cost. But in truth, you cannot afford not to prototype. Just look at the ways it can save you money. It can reduce the time spent in meetings trying to agree on direction. They can avoid changes caused by misunderstandings between stakeholders. They limit scope creep and the associated cost of retrofitting a new functionality. And they avoid building functionality that's not required. But the cost of not prototyping is more than just financial. It costs in time too. Projects stall, you miss deadlines, and opportunities are lost. The company wastes time because of a lack of clarity about what it's building. This time will ultimately cost the organization money and market share. Again, this is ironic as the argument against prototyping is a lack of time. Once again, I would argue that you don't have time not to prototype. Resist the urge to rush into projects or resort to lengthy specification phases. Instead, start with a prototype. I guarantee it will save you money in the long run. Now, there's no definitive answer to how you should go about making a prototype. Any of the approaches that we've outlined so far are perfectly valid. But before you can start building, it is worth asking yourself two questions. Number one, how much time do you have for prototyping? Many dismiss prototyping as a luxury only bigger projects can afford, but that's because most people think of high-fidelity prototypes rather than sketches on a piece of paper. In truth, prototyping can fit any budget and any amount of available time, but the approach you choose will depend on these factors. Decide how much time you can set aside for producing and testing prototypes. Once you've done that, you can decide what kind of prototyping that allows. If you only have a couple of hours, then sit down with the user and run through a few hand-drawn sketches, and that might be all you can do. If you've got a few days, then you can explore some wireframes with a handful of different sample users. Once you're getting into weeks, then you can build something more interactive and representative of the final product. You can also run multiple rounds of usability testing to validate your approach. That said, even these rich interactive prototypes often start out as just a few sketches. They're just taken further by the team over time. Although time is the biggest constraint, it's not the only consideration. You also need to ask yourself why you're creating the prototype in the first place. Prototypes can be used in many ways, from inspiring management to testing various approaches and establishing a clear direction. In many cases, it will be used in a number of these ways, but it's worth being clear about what your number one objective for your prototype is, and that's because it'll help you define your approach. For example, if your primary purpose for building a prototype is to excite management and sell them on your approach, then a highly designed prototype will probably be preferable. While if your objective is simply to test the website's information architecture, then really you need nothing more than some blank pages and a bit of clickable navigation. If you choose to use your prototype as a specification for your project, then it's going to need to be fairly detailed, including providing a strong sense of any interactivity required. But it's important to remember that a prototype can change over time. It can start simple and evolve, becoming increasingly representative of your final deliverable. In fact, in most cases, that's preferable. When you first start prototyping, a lot of what is being produced is educated guesswork. That means it makes sense to minimise the amount of effort you put into it, as you're almost certainly going to need to change it. That's why pen and paper or tools like Balsamiq are a good fit in those early days. As you become more confident in your direction based on the testing and discussion with stakeholders, you can start to flesh out your prototype by introducing depth, design elements, and better copy. A prototype should repeatedly pass through this loop of design, testing, and iteration. Each round of testing should help you refine the approach and ensure that you're heading in the right direction. Through this process of iteration, the details in your prototype should reflect how confident you are in your chosen direction. The more you work on it, the more finished it's going to feel. But this process of iteration can be damaging if it's allowed to limit your thinking. The problem with the process of iteration, it leads us to see our prototypes as a step along the road to the final solution, and in some senses it is. But that means anything we add to the prototype has to be practical. We'll need to get agreement for it, and we'll need to be able to build it on the agreed technology stack. This is the point where things can go wrong, because people worry that their prototype isn't going to be practical or it'll never get approved. And that's a dangerous mindset, as it immediately constrains the prototype. We start compromising the user experience because we know the development team will say it's not possible or because senior management are going to reject it. Depending on how we're going to use our prototype, that attitude could well be a mistake. For a start, we make a lot of assumptions when we decide some aspect of our prototype isn't practical. After all, it's possible to build anything. It just depends on how much we're willing to spend. As for stakeholders, we're often wildly wrong about what they'll accept or reject. We don't know until we try. Most importantly, prototypes within constraints sets the bar too low from the outset. Stakeholders never get to see what good looks like and how great a user experience really can be. If you show a stakeholder an outstanding experience, they often get really excited about it, and that motivates them to make it happen. It isn't until you show them what a good experience could be do they see its value. Only then do they become willing to make the compromises required to make it a reality. It's also surprising just how often our assumption about who will accept what proves wrong. Somebody who you thought would reject your approach can become your greatest advocate when they see the potential. Then there's the fact that showing an inspiring prototype can shift the conversation. Imagine for a moment that you wanted to design an experience you knew was impossible on the existing technology stack. It would fall to you to convince management that the whole technology stack needs changing, and let's be honest, that's going to be an uphill battle. But if you build a prototype that ignores the technology stack and management love it, then it now falls to the development team to explain why the technology stack can't support it. The burden of proof has switched. Now, I'm not claiming that if you prototype the perfect user experience, suddenly everyone will buy in and you'll get it approved. There will be compromises. But these compromises will begin from a high starting point, and everybody will be clear about what users and the business will lose if you compromise. If you don't show them what best practice looks like, they're never going to know the cost of that old technology stack or the company's out-of-date attitudes. This approach to prototyping, which is designed to inspire and excite stakeholders, works even better if you include them in the process of creating the prototype. The worst thing you can do when prototyping is work in isolation. Doing so will not only lead to an inferior solution, it will also undermine many of the benefits that I've been talking about. Delivering quality digital services requires many specialists working closely together and many more people to agree on the chosen approach. that makes it almost impossible for a single person to sit down and design a prototype. Who then needs to be involved? Well, the people you need will fall into two categories. Those who will produce the final digital service that you're prototyping, and those whose buy-in is required. Let's look at each in turn. You really need as many of the team who will be building the digital service involved in the creation of the prototype as possible. For a start, you obviously want a user interface designer in the room. Their expertise in visual hierarchy in particular will be invaluable. If you've got a separate user experience designer, make sure that that person is represented too. They will provide a perspective on how the service being prototyped fits into the broader customer journey. Having content specialists involved too is really important. They will be able to help you with messaging and information architecture. Then, if you have them, include any user researchers you have, somebody with a clear understanding of what the user wants to achieve and what questions they have. Finally, don't forget to include developers. They're often left out, but their involvement is crucial. Too often decisions are made at the prototyping stage that have serious ramifications for development further down the line. Beyond the core team, also include representative stakeholders from across the organisation. Typically, these might include senior management, people from marketing, product owners, those kinds of people. In fact, I would encourage you to have an open door policy when it comes to prototyping. If somebody wants to be involved, allow them. That's because if they're involved in the creation of prototype, they feel a sense of ownership over it. And if they've got a sense of ownership over it, they're less likely to criticize it and more likely to defend it to others. Admittedly, including a large number of people in the prototyping process can sound intimidating, but done right, it can be hugely effective. So how do you approach collaborative prototyping? Well, that's very much dependent on the number of people involved and who those people are. However, whatever the circumstances, not everyone needs to be equally involved. Depending on the type of prototype you're producing, some people will be doing more work than others. That said, some form of kickoff prototyping workshop with as many participants as possible involved is always a good place to start. It is an opportunity to explore lots of different ideas and move towards an initial direction. And one way of doing that is with something called a design sprint. Design sprints were born out of Google Ventures, the venture capital arm of Alphabet Inc. They were initially developed to aid startups to address business challenges they were facing. As the sprint website says, a sprint is a five-day process for answering critical business questions through design, prototyping, and testing ideas with customers. In many cases, that translated into defining and kicking off some form of digital project, although Google Ventures have used the technique beyond that field. Google has created a highly structured five-day process with activities defined for each day. So a typical design sprint runs something like this. Monday, the group works with experts from across the organization to identify the ultimate goal and map out the challenges for the week. Tuesday, the team starts exploring a variety of solutions through looking at sources of inspiration and sketching various approaches that they could take. Wednesday, the group looks at the solutions explored on Tuesday and decides which ones have the best chance of fulfilling the target for the week. The team then expands those sketched solutions into more comprehensive storyboards. Thursday, the group turns the storyboards into a working prototype designed to mimic the final approach ready for testing. And then Friday, the final prototype is shown to prospective users and its viability tested. The whole process is highly interactive, experimental, and user-focused. In short, it embraces many of the principles of design thinking to produce something tangible that everyone can agree on. The problem with design sprints is that they're very time-intensive. Although it may be possible to get your core team in the room for a week, getting other stakeholders might prove difficult, especially those in senior management. Monday does provide an ability for stakeholders to be involved in a more limited way, but that still leaves a danger of someone in senior management derailing the process further down the line if they don't like the output of the sprint. There are kind of two ways of addressing this problem. The first is that the senior management delegate authority to someone in the room that they trust. If they do go down this approach, then they need to recognise that they lose the ability to overrule later. The second approach is for them to check in regularly throughout the week to review progress. That will allow them to course correct the group if they're uncomfortable with the direction before too much work is done. Of course, getting 5 days of uninterrupted time from anybody is going to be tough, not just senior management. And that's why sometimes a shorter workshop is preferable. The key with shorter workshop sessions is to have a clear idea of your objective. It's also important to ensure you actually create something together rather than just have a very long meeting. What that something is will be dependent on time available. If you've only got a couple of hours, the best approach might be to focus on identifying a prioritized list of tasks and questions that the prototype will need to address. Given more time, you can explore the visual hierarchy and content of key pages in the prototype. And that can be done through a whole range of interactive exercises. Whether you're running a 2-hour-long workshop or a 5-day sprint, one thing you should always do is some research up front. Starting a prototype without really understanding your users will lead to disaster. It will result in a prototype that meets the needs of internal stakeholders while largely ignoring the user. For the final digital service to be effective, you can't allow that to happen. Any prototyping workshop has to be relentlessly focused on user needs, and that means you have to know what those needs are. You need to understand things like what the user's ultimate goal is, what tasks they're looking to complete, what questions they have, how they're feeling, what pain points the user wants help with, and where the prototype fits into that overall journey. With this in mind, before you start collaborating on a prototype, it's important to first undertake some user research. Go into the meeting with a customer journey map or some other form that visualizes your user research in order to help everyone focus on user needs. Hopefully by the end of the workshop, you'll have a clear idea of how you can meet those needs. What you won't have is a fully working prototype. That will need to be produced following the workshop. And that inevitably leads to the question of, well, what should we use to produce the prototype? There seems to be endless debate about which tool is best for prototyping, and in truth, there isn't one. They all have their pros and their cons, with each being better suited to different circumstances and situations. Some argue that you can't beat pen and paper. That is certainly true if you're in a workshop because everyone can draw boxes, but pen and paper lacks interactivity and is low fidelity. Others argue that you should prototype in the browser, and that's certainly great for evolving a prototype over time and is much more representative of the final deliverable, but it can be time consuming too. Then there's a plethora of prototyping tool from the likes of Balsamiq, which has got very low barrier to entry, all the way up to something like Marvel or Principle, which are highly interactive. Which of these tools you use is up to you. It's personal preference, really. But there are a few questions that you might want to ask to guide your decision making. Questions such as, is this regularly updated and developed? Does it have a community that creates downloadable libraries and preset objects that you can use? Does it let you assemble wireframes without fuss? In other words, could you do it quickly in front of a room full of people? Does it have a complete sitemap allowing you to jump back and forth between pages? Is it fast and responsive, even with larger projects? And can you build a working prototype with it in a fraction of the time it would take just to build it in HTML? Does it allow the creation of complex interactions when you need them? Does it allow the creation of realistic forms? What about logical operations, things like if statements and that kind of thing? Does it have templates or library functions of updatable objects that when you update them, it ripples through and updates the entire model? Does it support the visual appearance you want? And does it allow commenting and feedback from stakeholders? Which of those different questions matters to you will depend on the project and the type of prototype you're creating. But the last point about commenting and feedback is worth particular consideration. That's because sooner or later you're going to have to show your prototype to people who weren't involved in its creation. As you will have gathered by now, I'm a huge fan of prototyping, but they are not without their problems. The biggest of which is that they can confuse people who weren't involved in their creation. Those seeing a prototype for the first time are often left wondering what exactly they're looking at. Is it meant to be the final design? What does it include and what's left out? Is it set in stone or is it open to discussion? Prototypes are often so basic that stakeholders have trouble imagining what the final result will be. It's not uncommon to hear stakeholders exclaim, "Why is it black and white?" or "Is that going to be the final image?" This leads many of us to refine our prototypes over time. They start out basic when dealing with other digital professionals. Then they become a little bit more defined as we carry out some initial testing with users. And finally, we give them a nice coat of paint before showing them to anyone for sign-off. Unfortunately, that can backfire. If a prototype is too refined, it can fall into the uncanny valley. The uncanny valley is that term coined to talk about the depiction of people in animation, computer games, or robotics. Over the years, these depictions have become so advanced that they look almost human. But almost can be a problem. Something that looks almost human, but not quite, disturbs us. To our eyes, it appears not quite right. Something's off. And many stakeholders react in a similar way if our prototype looks too designed. If it looks like a finished website or app, but it's not. Sometimes it's not quite right and they start picking at it in an attempt to find the problem. Often the answer is to show them prototypes earlier, prototypes that are not as refined, prototypes that don't fall into the uncanny valley. Of course, the problem you now face is that clients don't understand what they're looking at, but that can be overcome with a bit of education. The danger comes when not everyone who sees the prototype receives that education. Maybe a stakeholder shows another colleague or somebody just sends them the link in an email. Whatever the case, they're not having the prototype explained to them, and that can be disastrous. So my preferred solution to this problem is a video. Whenever somebody visits the prototype, they first see a video, often as an overlay. Before they can view the prototype, I have an opportunity to explain what they're seeing. I start by making it clear the prototype isn't the final sight. The key to success with this approach is to present the prototype as a discussion piece. The first iteration of a prototype should never be what's built, but instead a vision of what's possible. Do that and you'll be shocked at just what gets approved. I then emphasise that the aim of the prototype is to gather feedback from stakeholders, but also from real users. I explain which user groups we are focusing on and what content and functionality we've included for those audiences. And finally, I make it very clear which audiences have not been addressed and which associated content has been left out. Depending on the stage of the project, I also sometimes request feedback. But if you do decide to take this approach, be careful. Never ask people for open-ended feedback. If you do, they're going to share their personal preferences, comments like, I don't like the colour, and they're not particularly helpful. Instead, ask structured questions, questions that help you improve the prototype, but also questions that help educate the stakeholder about what they should be focusing on. Questions such as, does the prototype enable our target audience to complete their tasks? If not, what tasks are missing? Does the prototype highlight our calls to action? Does the layout of the page emphasize the most important elements to us as an organization and to our users? Is the tone of voice in the copy consistent with our brand? Your final set of questions will depend on how refined your prototype is and what feedback you need, but you get the idea. Lead stakeholders away from personal preference by asking them the right question. You want to keep your videos as short as possible, but that doesn't mean you can't provide more information for those who are interested. Many of the videos I've produced appear alongside links to blogs outlining the work that we are currently doing. It's also useful to include a timeline so stakeholders can see how far you've progressed on the project and what there's left to do. If people can see progress, they're less likely to complain about you not having launched the site yet. Prototype videos and blogs and timelines may all seem like luxuries that your project can't afford, but if that project has a lot of stakeholders, they are going to be invaluable and will ultimately speed up the process. By keeping stakeholders informed and engaged, a project is much less likely to get derailed. That is, in my opinion, worth the investment. Now, I'm very conscious this is probably the longest podcast episode I've recorded here, but that's with good reason. Prototyping is the foundation of modern digital design. It's an incredibly valuable tool, so valuable in fact, that it can be used for a lot more than improving a user interface. Increasingly, businesses are adopting prototyping to solve all kinds of experience problems. I've seen prototypes used to address transition points between social media and a website or from a website to a mobile app. I've also seen it used to reimagine offline experiences too. As I said earlier, Disney had built a prototype showing how a magic band could improve the experience in their park, a prototype that led their executive to greenlight a $1 million renovation. However, I'm also conscious that prototyping can feel intimidating. It can involve changing how we've traditionally worked in organisations and persuading others to get on board with it. But I would encourage you to give it a go, to start small and simply do some sketches or initial wireframing. You can expand beyond that over time as people get used to it. Alternatively, drop me an email. I'd love to work with you to integrate prototyping into your organisation.